Hello, this is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki Balancing Form and Essence. Today I have with me Martin Auerkirk, and again, I've known Martin for many, many years. He was one of the first shows that I recorded, and he lives in the Netherlands. So I was there on a tour, and I was doing events, and we had a master's gathering, and after that, I nabbed him in a trailer, and we did this recording on a little recorder that I had, and that was 5 and something years ago. So I'm very happy to have Martin with us again today to update us on his research. And also, I'm just in a very different space about research and able to take in more of the information because, you know, 5 years ago, I just didn't really understand what the benefits of the research could be. And now, it feels very different, and maybe something has changed in me. I would imagine that's true. I'm not so defensive. But on the other hand, I feel like, the research, for instance, that Ricardo Manzani is doing in Brazil and, Ann Baldwin here in Tucson and, you know, other people around the world, this research is being done in order to more understand what the effect of Reiki has on the human being, and not just on a physiological level, but also emotionally and spiritually. And I'm just very excited to have Martin back, and thank you, Martin, for saying yes to our interview.
You're welcome.
Welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to participate.
Yes. If you could speak a little bit more directly into the microphone, that would be great.
Okay. Is this better?
Much better. Thank you. Martin, I would really love it if you could share with us your Reiki story, how you met Reiki and what that was like for you, and, you know, your Reiki story.
Okay. Oh, my Reiki story starts in 1992. And at that time, I was interested in New Age stuff like astrology, and I was actually at that time particularly interested in Kirlian photography. And I went to a fair, a New Age fair, where they had Kirlian photography equipment, and I went there and heard a lecture about it. But there was also Reiki there at that fair. It was in Zeeland, in the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. And I saw a person being treated with Reiki. And I looked at it from a real big distance, like 10 meters. And somehow it drew my attention. So later that evening, I talked to my wife about it. She also was there. And actually, she later that afternoon, we got a treatment from the same person, so she could tell how it was, that she really liked it. And it was as if in the weeks after that, I saw Reiki written everywhere or draw my attention.
Wonderful.
So after some weeks, I had, okay, this is something for me. And actually, for my wife, it was the same thing. And she's a very methodological person, so she was collecting leaflets from all Reiki masters.
Uh-huh.
So that's three of these leaflets in front of us. One was from Dick Nyssen, whom I still know and whom you also know.
Yes.
And two other ones. And so we chose the one from Dick, and we called him. And we got no answer. Later, I found out he moved from Lelystad to the farm where he now lives. So we had the old phone number.
Oh.
Yeah. So we chose another Reiki master who was a pupil of Joost Godschalks.
Oh, yes.
So I was taught Reiki by the method of Joost.
Uh-huh.
And at that time, I didn't know that it was a very, interesting method, and that was not really mainstream Reiki. But it did work for me and for my wife also. We took the course together, and about half a year later, I took second degree, and we worked with it a lot. Really, we liked working with it, but it was the method of Joost Godschalk, so we didn't learn any positions. We were just taught to use our intuition.
Mm-hmm.
I found out that my aunt learned Reiki some 2 years later, and my aunt lives almost next door to Dick Nijssen. And well, she was introduced by Dick, who was a new neighbor of them, and well, they really liked him, and they took the course, so they learned Reiki. And so I was so reconnected to Dick. And at that time, I was looking where I could do go for a master, for Reiki master.
Uh-huh.
So I talked, I visited him and talked to him and explained that we tried to reach him 2 years or 2.5 years before, but failed. But now we were reconnected. And I enlisted for his master course, which at that time took 1 year. And became my Reiki master teacher.
Uh-huh.
So in 1995, I became a Reiki master.
Wow.
But, soon after, I became a member of the Reiki Alliance, which was for me also a new world that opened.
Yes.
I went to the Gersfeld conference, the one that you were actually not there.
Right.
Everybody was really missing you, but I was not missing you because I didn't know you at the time. But it was for me, the Reiki conference was also a completely new world. To experience Reiki in a group of more than 100 persons, that was so overwhelming. So I didn't miss any conference for the next 10 years or so.
Wonderful.
Yeah. So I learned today that I'm a thrill seeker. So that was one of the thrills that I really liked to be in a Reiki, big Reiki group.
Uh-huh.
But later with Rolf Holm, we hit on one of his Reiki meetings. We try to really measure also the effect of a group. So to do really everything with Reiki synchronous and to try to measure whether we could to really see the effect on people in a group versus the effect on people single. Which failed, I don't know.
I was going to ask you, and what happened?
Yeah, I couldn't see any effect.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, yeah, I like to measure things. I like to understand things. And one of the things with Reiki was also that I really wanted to know how it worked and why it worked. And so I did several experiments on my work at Philips Electronics. I had access to very sensitive instruments like photon counters and very sensitive magnetic sensors, and I tried everything to measure what was coming out of my hands. And except for one instrument, I never measured anything. But when you use photon counting, that is the same equipment that is now used for measuring biophotons, then I could see a significant effect.
And what was that?
So I put my hand in front of the photo multiplier, so the sensor, in really in the dark. And so it would only see light coming out of my hands.
Oh,
it was measuring like 100 photons per second, which is almost nothing. And then I made with my hands one of the symbols. And I could see the photon dropping. It dropped like tenfold. So at the time I was more or less disappointed that not more photons were coming out. But I later found out that when you move from imperfection towards perfection, that you leak less information, you leak less photons. So by making the symbol, I was moving towards perfection.
Really? How did you find
only
that
time
out?
I really, yes?
How did you find that out, that when you...
That was a German scientist who really studied the biophotons thoroughly, and he worked with the photons coming out of leaves cut from a tree, fresh.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And he was hurting the leaf, like cutting some piece off it. Ooh. The photon flux really increased a lot.
Uh-huh.
And then he really looked at this, making things more perfect and seeing the photon flux increase, decrease.
That's fascinating. So what is your theory about that effect?
Yeah.
Well, I assume you have one. I mean, my mind leaps to something, but I'm interested in yours.
Yeah. So the only theory that I have is that the more you go into the matter, the more you go into this the manifestation here in Earth, uh-huh. the further away you are from heaven and from perfection. So, and if you are really one with God, then there is then you are already everything.
Uh-huh.
So there's no need for information coming going from one entity to another. So the separation disappears.
Uh-huh. Wow. That's cool. Thank you. That's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So, let's see, where were we now when we got off on photo things?
Yeah. We were talking about that I tried to measure Reiki and try to understand how it worked.
Great. So then what happened? You were a master, and did you start teaching then?
Yes, I started teaching. So I taught my first years the most classes, and I more or less stopped teaching gradually. So now I only teach a person when he really more or less begs me to teach him Reiki.
Uh-huh.
So it is very rarely that happens. So I taught a midwife Reiki several years ago, and she is now my greatest fan who is spreading the word, but I'm not advertising anything anymore.
Uh-huh.
She sees a lot of people because she's a midwife.
Yes, of course. So let's kind of go back a little bit. I'd like to just find out, you work for Philips, but, you know, with these big companies, I'm really lost about what they actually do. So what was your position, or what was your job at Philips? Because I associate it with electronics, so this is what my problem is.
Okay. Yeah, Philips used to be an electronics company who makes cassette recorders and television sets. But they stopped gradually doing that. And now they are a company who mainly makes healthcare products. And... apart from that, they make lamps. And so we have three main divisions, a lifestyle division, a healthcare division, and a lighting division. And I'm working for corporate research, so I know a little bit of everything.
Uh-huh.
I'm asked to think of new things.
Really? Oh, cool.
Yeah. I'm studying also recently the information in water. There's this Japanese guy, Emoto,
yes,
who makes these nice, lovely ice crystals. So I'm thinking of methods how to characterize it with normal sensors, and
yes,
how to think of products that can make unhealthy water into healthy water.
through his methodology.
Yes, partly through his methodology, but what Emoto claims is that even by thinking lovely thoughts, you make water more healthy.
Yes.
And to make a product, to make something in a box that does that is hard.
Okay, I can understand that.
Yeah.
But fascinating, because it really accompanies this practice of Reiki that you have, do you think?
Yes, yeah. Now it does. So when I started working for Philips 26 years ago, there was a big mismatch between the science I did there and my personal life and my personal interests. But they merged. Oh, yeah.
That's cool. Well, yeah. I can't wait for this water purification in a box. It should be really great.
Yeah, perhaps 5 years from now it's in the shops.
Great. So, you are doing some, before the show, we were speaking a little bit about what you're doing now. So, in the last 5 years or so, you've begun to work, on a kind of human level. Is that what you were saying? Found out how to, well, anyway, I think you can explain it if I give you a little lead.
In 2007, Philips started asking a group of people how they should deal with emotions, how emotions could be influenced on one hand, and on the other hand, how emotions could be measured. Now, that is quite a broad way putting things. And I was in the part of the group that was focusing on how to measure emotions. So, well, we were not really hindered by any know-how, because most of us were not psychologists, but scientists, physicists, or as I am, a chemist. And so we started busily making sensors and measuring a lot of people and seeing them respond to loud noises, and thought at that time, okay, now we are truly measuring emotions. If you start doing that and you do it with a lot of people, you learn things in between. You learn how different people are, or how it matters how people come into the room, or what they experienced in the weeks before they come to your experiment. So I more or less moved from measuring in a lab situation to measure people in real life. And there it becomes unpredictable what you measure. And unless you go to places where there are strong emotions. So I measured in intensive care wards. There, you're really sure to get strong emotions. And I measured on aggression of people in crisis centers of medical institutions.
Yes.
And I measured also top sports swimmers of the Dutch Olympic team.
You did?
Yeah.
Wow.
So the trainer was interested in how these people got, how they got so nervous before the championships, and whether he could do something about it.
And
because they spent a lot of their energy being so very nervous about whether they would win the medal or not. And by being nervous, that cost them a lot of energy. So they didn't win the gold medal then, but the silver.
So, were you able to answer his question?
Yes. he learned that the pattern of the stress buildup was really different from what he expected.
Really?
Yeah. So, but they still won the silver medal and not the gold medal.
Well, what do you mean by that? That it wasn't as he expected? Is it possible?
He expected that it was more steep. So I measured that they were more or less nervous half the day before they had to swim the finals. And not in the last 5 minutes that some kind of meditation would cool them down. But they were, and that explains why it cost them so much energy. But a lot of what depended on the, performing well in the finals.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, you could probably make trillions of dollars if you could figure out how to release the stress of athletes before they're. Oh, interesting. Fascinating. Yeah. So, what are you working on now? Can you tell us at all?
So,
or is it top secret?
Now I'm looking for new topics, and one of the new topics that I studied today was on addiction care. So, what aspects of addiction are interesting for our company? So there are several phases there. There's the early recognition that something is going wrong, that the person is becoming addicted to something, to substances or to alcohol. And there is the phase where the motivation is building up to do something about it. But the person is aware of the problem, but is not going to see help.
Right.
Then there is the treatment part, and in the end, you want to prevent relapse.
Right.
Yeah. So today we had a meeting with experts in the field, but also with insurance agencies, the health insurance, so the people who are usually paying for all this treatment to learn, to learn where the money is, so what they would be willing to pay, where the problems are, and it was a really interesting meeting. I learned a lot.
That's great. Well, it's fascinating. I don't know how it is in the Netherlands, but here we have gotten into another stage on the television, which I don't really like very much. But that is that there's a lot of advertising of drugs for things like insomnia and, you know, kind of everyday things that people have.
Uh-huh.
And then you're supposed to go ask your doctor about them. And it's very interesting to sit and listen to the consumer sort of the advertising go to the consumer rather than the doctor. So the instead of the drug companies going to the physician and telling them how good the drugs are, they go to the consumer themselves. So that's a change, actually, in the way that marketing is done, but also must be a change in the way that that people are actually getting educated themselves about different drugs. Do you find that to be true in what you're doing?
Yes, it was also addressed today that the internet is used by many people to really inform themselves about what is going on and what they can really do themselves about it or where they should get help.
It's
and there the advertisements are aimed at people looking for information in a way. Yeah.
Yes. Well, it's fascinating. And then, of course, at the very end, in a very quick voice, you know, and if you have heartburn or if you're taking this kind of drug, then you shouldn't use it. And they say it really fast at the end, right? Do you have these advertisements in the Netherlands? Yeah.
In the Netherlands, it's forbidden to do that type of advertisement.
Well, you all are really smart in a lot of ways. I mean, I just find this to be so misleading for people. And then, of course, they don't hear the last part. And they think that their doctors, I mean, I have heard some conversations because I live in a retirement community. So people here spend millions of dollars on drugs, you know, uh-huh. together. And yeah. I hear these conversations in the restaurant, like, you know, their doctor is withholding something from them because, you know, they saw on television that they could get this or that or the other thing. It's very strange, I mm-hmm. find, for healthcare.
Yeah. It tells a bit about how the money is influencing a lot of things. So
right.
these companies have a huge budgets for advertisement, but also for lobbying, yes? For lobbying
yeah, exactly.
to get their approval for their medicines.
Right, exactly.
There was actually one medicine banned by the FDA only a week after it was approved for children.
Oh my gosh.
That's insane.
That's terrible. So, well, back to Reiki.
mm-hmm.
Well, I guess we're all talking about healthcare, right?
Yeah.
So I felt like there were some things that you have been doing in the healthcare, in research, but I'd like to kind of back up myself because, I wrote a little 4-question interview with a Brazilian magazine, today, actually. And one of the things that he asked, this editor asked, was what I thought the significance of the research was these days. And I don't know whether it was just the people that I was talking to, but it seems like in the last 10 years, and I'm talking about starting in 1980 when I first really came on the Reiki scene. So 20 years later, what I realized was that the actual way of being able to measure the physiology of people is different, has advanced to the point where these physiological changes in our body are able to be measured. Is that true, that some of these measuring equipment are new within the last 10 or 15 years?
Yes, in 1980 or the 80s, actually the Holter monitor was the only monitor that was available in the field.
Right.
All other things you needed to measure in a hospital or in a lab setting. And right now there are a lot of things that you can measure in the field. So the heart monitor is one, but I myself make a skin conductance sensor, which measures all the stress a person experiences, but also the relaxation. If you don't measure stress, you can really measure a person relax. I love to meditate, and during meditations, I can see how undisturbed I can relax. And also, I found out by measuring that how long I stayed relaxed after the end of the meditation,
mm-hmm.
how it lingered. Those are things that could not be measured at that time mm-hmm. at all.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad, because this is what I said in my little response. So I'm glad I'm accurate, just to check that out. So what are the normal, I won't say that. But what are the common ways of measuring? Like, you were talking about a heart monitor, so that measures the beat of a heart? How many times your heart beats in a minute, or?
Yeah, so this is one of the things it can do. So you can measure the interbeat intervals, and then you try to measure really every beat, and then you look how the intervals between the beats vary. And a person who is really well rested and or meditating, there these intervals vary according to a sinus. So there is a certain frequency in there, and that is the frequency of the breathing. So if you practice slow breathing, then your heart rate variability is really very regular. And that is a very healthy state to be in.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I measured that one time while a person was being treated with Reiki for a number of consecutive days.
Yes.
there I saw that the periods that these persons were in this state increased, and also the heart rate became lower. So each day it became a little bit lower. The first day the average heart rate was 70, the second day it was about 65, and then 62, and then 60. So, and this lowering of the heart rate tells a bit about how relaxed the person gets.
I see. And did you measure how long that lasted at that point, or no?
No, I only measured during the treatment. Uh-huh. So it was a group treatment, so it was about half hour.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Interesting. And what other kinds of instruments do you have now that you can measure a physiological change?
So you can measure the respiration of a person by seeing how the chest goes up and down.
Uh-huh.
And you can do that with video. You can put an infrared matrix projected over the chest of a person, and then you can really see also whether the breathing is abdominal, so when it's really deep breathing. And that is also very good to breathe really deeply.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And then you can see the rate of breathing.
Mm-hmm.
Usually it's very high for people. It's between 12 and 20 respirations per second, or per minute. And when you are meditating or really relaxed, it is 6 or even lower.
Really? That much difference?
It's a big difference, yes.
Wow, amazing. And do you find that, I don't know if you've measured this, but I'd be interested to know if you've measured, like, people who do hands-on treatment and then people who have done distant treatments. Have you ever gotten into that?
Now I have to lose my memory.
Okay.
I believe I tried measuring distance treatment, but it was really like 15 years ago.
Uh-huh. So
yeah.
Too long.
But I don't think much came out of it.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, you were telling me, I really would love to explore this piece that you were telling me about, that you, a while ago, that you were trying to measure the effect of Reiki, and mm-hmm. that somehow you measured it by hand when you were doing Reiki by hand, and then, well, you tell the story about perfection.
Yes, so that is the story where I try to measure the actual Reiki. Yeah? So I want to measure the stuff coming out of my hands.
Okay, good.
Yeah. And those that were the only thing there where I succeeded there was with the photons. So the amount of light per second, the amount of photons per second coming out of my hands was influenced by making the symbol.
Right. Yeah. And when you made the symbol, the amount of photons coming out of your hands reduced. Is that true?
That is true, yes.
And so
I was at that time accompanied by a person experienced in measuring biophotons. So, and he was looking at the readings, and I asked him, is this a significant drop? And he said, yes, it is a statistically significant drop. So I was reassured there that it was not a fluke, but it was truly something that was happening there. I didn't move my hand. I just, in my mind, draw the symbol and spoke the mantra.
Interesting. So, in that, you were saying something about someone else who had been doing experiments, and when they got to closer to perfection, there was a marked change in the measurement of certain things. Is that true?
Yes, there's the most well-known researcher of biophotons is Fritz Popp. It's a German scientist, and he was really studying everything about the topic of biophotons. And when he was studying how much photons came out of a leaf, which was just cut of a tree, then he saw that a certain amount of photons came out of it. And when he really cut the leaf, so really damaged the leaf with a scissor, then he could see out of the damage coming a lot more photons. So the higher the damage of something, the more photons came out. Mm-hmm. And these are biophotons. Huh? So it was a living leaf. So the moment the leaf dies, then the photon flux stops.
Uh-huh. So there is a saying or a belief, or I don't know what it's called, that when you're truly in the moment of perfection, you're in a space where there's no time, there's no space, there's no relativity. It's just perfection in the moment. So yeah. At that point, then there would be very few, if any, photons being emitted.
Yeah. So at that point, you're connected with everything, and by being connected with everything, you're also out of this material world. So you go. You become omnipresent. And so then there is no flow of photons or whatever, because you are everything. And then.
Wow.
Yeah.
So there's no flow of photons because you're everything.
Yeah, there's no information flow. So this is what Fritz Popp postulated, that this, all these photons were only to communicate between one living entity and another. So it was a exchange of information. But once you become everything, then you experience everything, and there's no other material need to exchange information.
Okay, so I'm just thinking about hand sensations when we do Reiki.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in the beginning, quite often, people have very exciting results from laying their hands on.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this, we could call it phenomena of sensation, sometimes seems to reduce. And then there are people who don't have sensation at all. And uh-huh. I just wonder if there's any way to extrapolate a kind of theory from this particular biological phenomena to that. And feeling like, you know, like the more healthy someone is, the less likely you are to receive hand sensations. Whereas if someone has a very acute condition, then the hand sensations become sometimes so dynamic that it actually feels like pain in the person who's giving the treatment.
Yes, I recognize that. I have the same experience.
Uh-huh. So is it possible to put these two experiences together?
Oh, yes. For me, it is also a method of information exchange. You can scan with your hands a person and sense by that the sensation in your hands where treatment is most needed. It's something I truly believe.
Uh-huh. And you feel like you need to be trained to do that, or is it something that comes naturally?
For me, it came natural. I couldn't tell.
I see. Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, I've not practiced it, so I don't know.
But it is what Joost Godschalk also taught, you should not do the regular hand positions, but just use your intuition and feel how long a place needed treatment.
Right. Well, it's interesting because, it's a really interesting paradox to teach Reiki, because I'm always going, well, Reiki goes where it's needed and you just follow your hands and, listen to your hands and so on. And then I also teach these hand positions. So it becomes a paradoxical situation where for new students, sometimes it's not confusing. It's just reassuring that they can have something for their mind, like hand positions and so on. And they don't have to be responsible, so to speak, for deciding where to put their hands, that they have a position already laid out for them. And that, in theory, as they get more experience with Reiki, then they can follow their hands with more assurity. And I don't know, I mean, the thing about hand positions is that then we get into this whole discussion about when does it become dogma? You know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah, I think you're right, but when I returned to Joost, his class, after having been taught by Dick Nyssen what the actual hand positions were, all the pupils of Joost asked me, Martin, you know the hand positions, please show me.
Oh dear.
Joost was refusing to do that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So people really want to have to know what to do.
Yeah.
But
then
you take something also away from them by showing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is such a delicate balance. It's a really interesting one, and I feel like it depends on the nature of the class how much I emphasize one or the other, but I try to give people a balance and hope that they will take the balance away with them and that Reiki will provide the balance for them if I hint at it. So I try my best. So we'll just, I don't know what the result is because I haven't really interviewed my students after some years of practice. Mm-hmm. Well, fascinating. So that's I just taught a first degree class last weekend. And, always one of the questions is, well, what do these sensations mean? And now if I said, well, there are two separate entities conversing with each other. Or how would you say this if you were talking about it being communication?
Yeah, I would call it tuning. So you're tuning into the person who you want to treat. And you do that either with a distance treatment, you tune in with the symbol, but it is a method of tuning in.
Uh-huh. And your hand, the messages that come to your hands are also tuning in.
Yeah. So you really become a receptor then. Huh? So if you tune in, you're not sending out messages, but you try to listen, in this case, and to listen to your hands.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Oh. So, tell me something. I've been getting into conscious listening lately, and I have a question. For you, this listening of the hands, is this only listening, or do we go to the next step, which is usually what happens to human beings, which is that they then have conclusions about what these sensations mean? And I try to get my students not to do that, but just to accept the sensations as they are. And I'm wondering what happens with you inside yourself as a master, but also as a scientist. When you see a phenomena happening, do you then jump to another conclusion, or do you stay with the experience?
So, my wife is an aura reader, and this technique of aura reading works only when you have a reference, so when you can refer to something that you experienced yourself. So I believe that I can only experience something in another person that I have a reference to.
Yes.
So I can recognize headache of the types that I experienced myself, and right. And etc. So I'm aware of that, and so when I when somebody complains about something and I don't feel anything, then it's probably beyond my frame of reference.
Uh-huh.
But when I do feel it, then still I have to be aware that I can only feel the aspects that are fitting to what are in my frame of reference.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I look at it.
Uh-huh. So when we're, you know, doing these, when we're reading about these scientific experiences and research projects, what is a good posture for us to hold them in? You know, like, I'm glad that the research has moved from proving that Reiki exists, which was really crazy, to,
yeah.
to, just being curious about the actual effect that Reiki has on physiology, but also on emotion. So I'm wondering, I'm wondering where you've come to with that. In the sense of,
that is a good question. So, what I've learned in the past 5 years is that people are so different that everybody is really, really unique, and that psychologists and also medical persons try to measure a group of people and then take the average. And the average is actually corresponding to nobody in the group.
Right.
It's just the average, and the spread is huge. So what I love most about what I do with measuring emotions is that my frame of reference increases. So I get more feeling of how it is to do top sport, or how it is to be a criminally insane, or just by seeing their response to stressors or to what is happening. I've measured people whom they thought they were dying, and I measured really strange things. The person recovered, fortunately. But to really do research about Reiki on a group of persons and then try to say, well, this is it, I don't think it's possible, personally. Reiki is giving effects that are really very personal to everybody.
Wonderful. How exciting. And such a relief. Because, you know, we all have our kind of bottom line of why we got into Reiki, and perhaps some of my defensiveness came from my own my own inner motivation to find something in my life that I could do that would celebrate the individual, and we would be able to create our lives from our own individual needs, and that, you know, this is a conclusion that you've come to is so wonderful for me. And at the same time, I see that there's this, there are generalities to Reiki that we could put out, and it's an interesting, but they're not always true in the sense of this will happen all the time.
Yes.
Yeah.
So then you should indeed fall back on measuring the effects on a large group of people and averaging it out. And then if you communicate this as being the result of the study, you have to have a disclaimer that the spread is immense because it can be completely the opposite.
Interesting. Well, Martin, we're almost out of time, if you can imagine. And I just wondered if, as you know, sometimes one of our great generalities comes to me like, well, how can a scientist be a Reiki master? And you spend all your time while you're giving treatments trying to figure out what you're doing. And my answer after this hour of talking to you is, I don't think so, but maybe you can answer my question.
I don't see a problem in approaching Reiki with my scientific curiosity. It gives me a different angle to experience Reiki. And so one of the things that I like about the Brazilian research is that they focus on the length of the treatment and how really long treatments are beneficial. And then I think of Hawayo Takata's experiences where she teaches a whole family and just say, well, treat this person around the clock. And
exactly. Well,
whoever does this nowadays, you perhaps know, but I know of nobody. But perhaps there's the answer, that the more you do Reiki, the better it works.
Yes. Well, on occasion, when there's a huge crisis, sometimes this happens. But it is not the general practice, and I think that people have this expectation of Reiki as being, as creating miracle. And one of the things that I've come to realize in my own life lately is just that my way to identify a miracle is changing. And I had an aha insight about 6 months ago. I was telling the story of Reiki, and someone in the class asked me, well, are these really miracles? Because in the story, I go, you know, he trips, he stubs his toe, he holds his foot, and, you know, the blood stops. You know, somebody said, well, is that really a miracle? Like, maybe a miracle is to grow back a foot or, you know, to make a blind man see and so on. And I said, well, you know.
Well, I healed a third degree burn with Reiki in half an hour. And really a piece of my flesh was gone. Wow. And after treating my finger, I was pain-free. I forgot about it even.
Wow, that's cool. And all of us have those kind of major things, right? But, you know, miracles happen to us daily, and they are everyday occurrences. And I know that the New Age people, they say this all the time, and I used to poo-poo them a little bit. But now I realize that if I can go back to a kind of childlike attitude of how the world works and to accept the mystery of how things come together, then not getting sick after eating a meal that, you know, most people would be ill from is a miracle. And, you know, picking up a phone and calling someone and having them say, wow, I was just thinking about you, is like this miracle of communication. So, I feel that the scientific research is creating a pathway for us to really understand that miracles happen even on a physiological or measurable, kind of space. In an everyday way, like the miracle of our heart beating, you know, for the whole day, for instance. Mm-hmm. So it's been a really interesting 6 months for me. Thank you so much for your time, Martin, and for your sharing of what your life has been. It's so fascinating.
You're welcome. Wonderful. What a pleasure talking to you.
Yes. So, you listeners, just know that there are miracles happening every day, and that, you know, science is not our enemy, and I say that for myself, because it used to be that I felt like researchers would come and find out that Reiki wasn't measurable and wasn't able to be measured, and so would say that it didn't exist. But now our scientists have Reiki, and they're using their Reiki and their experience to create a beneficial relationship between this form and essence, the form of our physical body, how it works, and the miracle of that, with the essence, the mystery of who we are as human beings. And I just really love it, Martin, that you and Ricardo and other people out there in the world are creating this synergy within yourselves. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki, Balancing Form and Essence.